Okay, let's get started.
Good afternoon.
Morning.
No one got blown over today.
Almost.
I was just saying, I was walking down baseline, and I literally almost got knocked on my face because the wind was pushing me so hard from behind. I was like, wow. I think I'm going to take the bus. Yeah.
My plan for today, so first our proposals, you should be getting them into your TAs by tomorrow. If you got them in, I expect this to be a work in progress, but if you meet the guidelines that we outlined for the proposal, you'll get full marks. We're not being overly strict on that, but you're going to then have to, you might have to negotiate with your TAs whether you've actually established reasonable milestones. I think the tendency of a lot of you will be to overestimate what you can do or set your goals a bit too high. Some of you may set your goals a little too low. Well, so they will help you with that. What I'm going to try doing now, there will be tutorials continuing at least for the next several weeks. But the tutorials will not be required. But what I will have there, that'll be time for to meet with your TAs. The TAs will be there and also to meet with your teammates, use that as collaboration time, but we will set up exercises for you to do with various pieces of technology for you to do, and I can go through the answers for those in class the following week.
Thank you.
How does that sound?
That sounds good.
Okay, so use them as you see fit, and we'll see how that goes. Yes?
Dumb rhetorical questions, but for the proposals, putting them into the readme.md on the GitHub is the equivalent of...
That is the submission.
Yes.
Because I can make you go through CULearn, but you're putting it all in GitHub anyway, so why?
The twist on that is, if we send a pull request, is that enough, or do we have to actually push it onto the master?
You control both ends.
So push it.
Yes. Well, push it or pull it yourself. I mean, that's...
Well, the pulling is... So, like, you do a pull request, and...
And then someone has to do the pull, has to say,
right.
Yes, you may pull, but maybe one of you does the pull request and the other teammate commits it.
Presumably, you should...
That's a good way of ensuring agreement in the proposal. But, yeah, so you don't have to violate what we've been telling you with how to use the Git repository.
Well, technically, like, there's that... Wait a day, and if nobody did it, then you just wear it.
Yes, exactly. But again, I hope everyone on your team is in agreement. For any of you who do not have a team yet, you're definitely behind. Come talk to me as soon as possible. There are a couple of you. We can try to do some last minute matchmaking with the TAs tomorrow. So tell me or tell a TA that you're looking for a partner, and tomorrow morning when I meet with the TAs, we'll try to figure something out. So, by the time of a proposal, if you don't have a team for your proposal, you have a problem. So, we're a month into the term here, so. Wow, time flies. Anyway, so what I'm hoping today to talk about is to talk... a bit more specifically about the pieces of Node technology that you're going to be using and relating those to the underlying web technologies and try to connect those and also explain session management. So I realize that's another big conceptual thing that you guys all don't get, and it really differs from desktop programming. So let's start with web server and your browser. The server and browser talk to each other. How do they communicate? Well, so it is TCP/IP, but HTTP. So this is web, we're talking. So what will happen here is you'll have the web, things are initiated from the browser, right? So we have an
HTTP GET or POST generally?
Yes?
Ostensibly, the server could be doing timed events on its own, right?
Yeah, but it has to be as part of one of these open requests. There's no way...
Well, the event loop, like, if you just had a timer...
Yeah, yes, but there's no way for the server to directly connect back to a client if there's not an open channel.
But, I mean, like, if you get this node app that has the browser...
Then you have an open connection, yes.
But outside of that, to update the backend store, it might actually be doing timed events that...
But that's not between the server and browser.
No.
That's...
Right.
Stuff. Yes. So we're just trying to talk about the server and browser, and the server may have... When we say server, it's not necessarily one machine. I mean, if you're talking in the case of Google or something, there might be thousands of machines. They're all... But fundamentally, your browser sends an HTTP GET or POST request. Then there's a response, which is normally some sort of document. Normally encoded in HTML. The browser renderer gets this. So the browser renders the HTML. That's your classic access a web page thing that a web server and a web browser do. If only the world was so well. It used to be very simple, and now it's much more complicated. So, a server in this situation is not where the complexity lies. The complexity of the system really is in the browser. Browsers are crazy complicated. And they're crazy complicated because of the nature of these documents. Because when we say HTML, it used to be something very simple, and now it's something very complicated. So, what is HTML? I mean, I talked a bit about this, that it's a derivative of SGML, and it's kind of related to XML.
Markup language.
So, it's a markup language. Okay. So, it's a text document in a markup language. Originally, we think of markup languages as encoding document presentation. So it means that, so in the context of HTML, we have tags. We have a start. Well, we have, let's say a template header, H1/H1. So you have this text document in here with these sort of tags encoding it, with the beginning tag HTML and the document type and a header and a body. Not very complicated. You don't strictly have to even have all these parts. Web browsers will deal with malformed documents in various ways, but you have these text tags. Where's the JavaScript? In a script tag. So the standard says that in these tags that you have here, there exists one particular set of tags called script. Which will have a program, a script. Now at one time, the language that was in the script was variable. But nowadays, it's JavaScript. But there was a time when people talked about putting Perl and stuff into these things, but now it's JavaScript. So you send an HTML document to the browser. The browser, in this HTML document, there are some number of regions with code in them embedded inside of this. So the browser, in rendering this, also runs this code in some way.
from a standard desktop point of view, saying you want to make an interactive application, it's going to, you start the program app, you have an event loop. The event loop basically waits for an event to happen from the user. But well, first it does initialization. Then it has an event loop where you have some number of events saying, okay, when this happens, do this. When this happens, does this. And then you kind of loop through all the events, and then you end the program when an ending condition has happened. What's the event loop here? What does it look like?
Well, browser reads in the document, parses the stuff that's already there in static, executes the script and looks whether the script wants to make any changes right away, or if it requests monitoring of user-generated events, and then kind of proceeds on from there, monitoring the events and any other event loops that are generated by the script that it executes.
So, logically, there are two event loops.
There's the event loop. There's an event loop here. And there's an event loop here in the browser. There's an event loop running for each document that is loaded. And there's an event loop for the browser, for the server, which is running to service for incoming requests. It's basically, oh, when I get this request, I do this. When I get this, I do this.
Ostensibly, could there be more than one event loop within the same document?
Depends which.
Have child documents.
Yeah, it depends on how you define the document.
Right. So if it's like a frame set, then.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But exactly, yes. And so. The browser is has implemented the event loop for you. You don't implement the event loop directly, but you instead instantiate event handlers. It has default event handlers. You say, for this event handler, I want to do this. For this event handler, I want to do this. Things like when you move the mouse, when you click on a button, when you do a down clear. Those events, you define JavaScript code to handle them. Just like with a desktop application, you can define event handlers. But there's also events that correspond to the nature of this thing, which is it was loaded. Let's say you want to run some JavaScript as soon as the page has been fully loaded. Now, it's in general important to wait till your page is fully you might not want to wait till your page is fully loaded. Waiting for your page to be fully loaded is in general nice because then you have all of the document to work with. If you wait till it's only partially loaded, you might only have part of the document, and that might confuse your program. But if you want to wait for the document to be fully loaded, there is an event that corresponds to that. OnLoad. So that's another event. In addition to user events, you can say, when the page is finished, I can have my code run then. So you don't control the event loop. You don't control the exact event handlers, but they're implemented for you here. Similarly, you don't implement the direct event handler here on the server. A node gives you an event handler. When you use the right frameworks and stuff, you get you define responses to appropriate events. But the events are requests of URLs. So first part of complexity of dealing with web applications is these multiple event loops. You have this event loop sitting here in the server, and you have one or more event loops running. Well, actually, you generally have more than one, because let's say one user is loading multiple pages from the same website. Many users are interacting with with the same website. Each of them is running their own event loop in their browser, in that particular tab or window. And those event loops are all interacting with the server's event loop. So flow of control, what happens out, in terms of ordering of code, is in principle complicated in a web application. I mean, heck, the user might have hit the back arrow. There's all kinds of strangeness here. So this is probably the two things you have to get your head around when you're building web applications is the fact that this here is relatively slow, that communication path. And then second, you've got all these event loops that you have to coordinate in some way. And trust me, the way to coordinate these things is not to try to figure out the logical sequence of everything. That's a recipe for doom. You will not understand the exact ordering. You have to really think of things in a very myopic way. This is, I think of it a little bit like when you try to think of recursive programming. If you try to think of the entire recursive computation, you get very confused. But if you think about the base case, and then you think about each incremental case, it's like, then, okay, these pieces can fit together, and then you can make an argument about how they all fit together, and you have the logic of your application. The same way here, you have to think about each little loop in its own context. But you have to think of it completely decoupled, and realizing that in general it will be completely out of sync with any other event loop. You cannot guarantee any sort of ordering between these events unless you explicitly put it in there. Now you might say, what a crazy way of programming distributed applications. And you'd be right. Because this is not classic client-server programming. Classic client-server programming would be you have a TCP/IP connection, you have this synchronous communication, you all can guarantee ordering. When you send information from client to the server, then it sends back a response, then it sends a server. You have this nice semantics, sequential semantics, no parallel stuff. This is all asynchronous parallel garbage. So, given I've told you this messiness, yeah, we have to kind of live with it, but why is it more than just historical messiness? Why is this in some sense the way it had to be for the web? This, I would say, is fundamental to building a scalable, robust, distributed computing architecture. Something like this. Didn't have to be necessarily built on web technologies, but it had to have something kind of like this. Why is that? Too many things at play, but it's more, what happens if you make a request, you get a response, and then this web app now makes another request? What happens if the server has gone down that you're originally talking to? Might go, oh crap, everything broke. Well, what if you're trying to scale a web application to run over, to deal with thousands or millions of individuals, maybe even concurrently? If you're someone like Google, you don't care if the individual server goes down. Server goes away, who cares? I've got another one. I got 10,000 other ones. So the request just goes to there, and all that is required is that for that particular request, the server has to know what kind of response it needs to give. Coordination with what happened in the past, coordination with what happened in the future, is not needed. Except as far as the particular logic of our application is required. So if you're talking to Wikipedia, Wikipedia does not need to remember your state in general from past to future, unless maybe you're editing a page. If it does, then it needs to remember some notion of state, but otherwise it accesses whatever you want. See, this gives you inherent scalability, this decoupling. It's a pain, but it's necessary. So in this world, what is a session? When we talk about web sessions, what are we really talking about? String?
Opening and closing of an HTTP connection?
Is it an individual HTTP connection? No. Sessions span HTTP connections. That is the whole purpose of a session. A
is that individual HTTP connections are full, are TCP/IP connections, which means you open a connection, there's a handshake, it sends data back and forth, but individual HTTP connections are, I mean, they can be long-lived, but in general, they will be short. They'll exist for the long enough for you to load the page, and then they go away.
But isn't Node all about the whole chunked quasi-persistent HTTP connection where you like hook in and you expect things to go back and forth?
So that you do for efficiency to do that, but the semantics of your application cannot depend upon that. It can't be the only way of doing it. You have to, in general, expect an application to be disconnected, switch networks completely, switch IP addresses completely, and then continue where it was. It's like my phone, for example, when I'm using a web app, I'll be for a while be on the cell phone network, then I'll be on Wi-Fi here, then I'll go home and I'll be Wi-Fi at home. You know, it's, I'll have all kinds of different network connectivity, and the server has to be able to deal with that. But the TCP IP connections that were underneath broke each time. They went away. So if the notion of a session with the web is how do you bind together multiple HTTP requests? So these individual, you know, get and post and then the document here, you want to say, well, I've just gotten 20 of these requests, and these 20 requests, coming in some order, all have to do with one particular user, one particular browser, one particular instance of my web application. So the two simplest ways to do this, there are other ways. The two simplest ways is either to have a cookie or to have a weird URL, basically some sort of identifier at the end of the URL. There are these very storage technology, but the, in general, cookies are what is, you know, what is normally used. And so all the cookie is along with this request, because it's going to this particular domain, it will include any cookies appropriate for this URL, for this domain. They will be sent along automatically. And so the server will say, oh, I got this request. Oh, here's this cookie. Oh, it's an identifier. It's a session identifier. And it can go look it up in its back-end store and say, which, you know, for this session, what were we last doing? What is needed right now? So you can impose any sort of sequential semantics you want to on an application by using those individual identifiers that are sent to you. But that's the only thing you could depend upon. Otherwise, you have no idea. Each request has to be considered independently. No idea what's happening on the other end. So you can see what, when we talk about web security, these session identifiers are key. Because if I steal your session identifier, I am you. Because it's not identifying you based on what machine you're connecting from or what IP address you're connecting from or anything else at the lower levels. That stuff is all changeable. All it does is says, you've got that session identifier, I know who you are. So I steal that one, I have you.
HTTPS, is that playing to?
So, HTTPS, so, HTTPS makes this all more complicated. Because the reason why it makes it more complicated is because HTTPS has its own notion of a session. And it has its own notion of a session because it has to do the encryption. So, but again, HTTPS sessions can also be ephemeral. They don't have to be, but they can be ephemeral. So even if you're doing HTTPS, you can try to bind your cookies to the session, but you can't rely on everything happening through one HTTPS connection. So
does it rehash the keys every time it reconnects?
I could explain the protocol, but basically, yeah, you're getting every time there's a new HTTPS connection, you're using different session keys.
Okay. So although in general they kind of expect it to sort of be persistent, it's not something by design.
So if HTTPS was so good by itself, you wouldn't have to worry so much about closing down your browser afterwards.
because everything would be forgotten. But now, it's a mix of things. So, but because to one approximation, HPS is HTTP. It's just that with encryption. But in order to do the encryption, it has its own notion of session. So, in general, for application level session management things, you can use that, you can leverage that thing to for your cookies, but you still have to be able to deal with multiple connections. That's why secure apps also use cookies.
So the cookies here are generally, I mean, they don't have to be, but they're used for session management. But this notion of a session does not have strict sequential semantics. It's not A, then B, then C, then D happens. If you want to impose a strict ordering on what on how your application works, you have to do that. And in general, when you do that in a web application, it annoys the crap out of users. It's things like, you can't hit the back button. That breaks the web app. Have you ever seen a web app that does that? You hit the back button and then everything breaks and you can't do anything?
Yes.
It's like, that basically it's because it's trying to impose sequential semantics. It's not dealing with the events as they happen. It's just like...
Normally
you
know. Done by IBM or Citrix or any other giant conglomerate thing. Right.
Oh, God.
They love to code web apps like desktop applications.
Yeah, when you code a web app like a desktop application, that's what happens. So, don't do it. Don't do it. Well, that's the point of using these abstractions. I mean, it's not just Google WebTools. There's multiple ways of doing this that will take care of these sessions. But still, your application has to be designed to be organized around events. That's an that's a developer level concern. You can say, when this happens, my application will do this. When this happens, my application will do this, and not assume that. Okay, this event, then this, and then this event happens. You have to assume they happen in any order, and if there are some orders that make no sense semantically, you have to catch those and stop it. So really almost think of the fact that your program is written as a text document that has a nice sequential order is irrelevant to the logical order in which your code is executed. It's just convenient for editing.
So does this necessitate constant checking for whether something's been done if you're trying to do something more complicated than like a rollover in the sense of...
This is what I'm talking about if you're talking to the server. If you're inside of the browser, this is just one event loop. You can do desktop-like things in the browser. You can treat the desktop this as a little desktop application because it's just one event loop in this page. So what are the technologies that are used to make the page? So I made one HTML. So when I say HTML, there's kind of, let's say this is the let's talk about things like blink tags, boldface, div tags, you know, things to just make a basic layout of a page. What? They've been around forever.
No. But it's changed. Because it used to be like everything mashed together, blinking, and it became stripped out to structure, and now it's heading into structure with all sorts of other crazy semantic things that
right.
are ostensibly structured, but not really.
Yes.
How much older is HTML than JavaScript?
About 4 years, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, 4 years, yeah.
Oh, and I guess in programmer years, that's like 5 decades.
Well, when I say old HTML, I'm just saying the... when I say old, you know, I'm not saying HTML is old.
The tradition of HTML?
Let's say traditional. Yeah. So what I want to try is identifying the technologies and what they do. And when you talk about HTML, you're talking about this conglomeration of things that keeps growing. So the old ones had semantic markup. /visual.
a little bit of sound.
Visual markup, that bothers me.
Bold? Italics?
B in italics, that's all semantic. It just so happens that...
No.
B doesn't exist anymore, it's deprecated.
But original HTML did have visual markup. Link tag is visual markup.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I was saying. What I'm saying is that originally, HTML was designed. SGML, its predecessor, was purely for semantic markup. What is the difference between visual markup and semantic markup? A visual markup is you're saying, how should it look? Semantic markup says, what is it? Like, for example, HTML has this notion of a code tag. This is code. It's not saying how the code, what font it should be in, what layout it should have, what margins it should have, nothing. It just says code. This is code, start code, end code. Or this is a quote. Here's a quote, here's the end of a quote. That's semantic markup. Visual markup is like, this is bold. This is blinky. This is red. Now, yes?
So, style sheets?
I'm getting there. Yes?
So how is quote a semantic markup? How is quote a semantic markup then?
Quote, as in begin quote, quotation. A quotation from another document?
Within your text.
I'm not saying quotation marks. I'm saying quote.
Like Socrates said, blah, blah, blah. Usually that's italicized, centered, with quotation mark. But then you have to
change the way it looks.
No, the idea is, how should a quote be rendered? What should it look like? What font should it be in? Should it be in italics? Should it be bold-faced? Should be indented. Should be a first line indented.
Have a little line beside it.
Should have a line beside it. There's all these visual ways of rendering how a quote should look. In traditional HTML, there was a mix of visual and semantic ideas in how things should look. But the basic idea was the creator of the page, the creator of the document, shouldn't get overly concerned with exactly how this thing looks. Remember, Tim Berners-Lee was a physicist. He was not a graphic designer. He said he wanted to make the documents, you know, readable and stuff. And yeah, we might want to put some, you know, cute pictures or something. But screen sizes would change. There'd be different devices. He was thinking that the browser would have to adapt the presentation to the device. And there'd be different ways of doing this. And so tell the meaning of the document, and the browser would decide what would be appropriate for that. That was part of the original vision of HTML, was the semantic markup. But it only went halfway towards it, because it also stuck in a bunch of convenience types of things like make this text boldface, make it italic, and then later color. And what's happened over the course of the evolution of HTML is it's gotten more and more facilities for doing better and better visual markup. And you might have heard something called the semantic web. So there is work on semantic presentations, but semantic presentations of the web require a whole different problem to be solved. Have you heard of ontologies? What's an ontology? An ontology is a division of meanings. It's a way of, when you have an ontology to describe something, I'm trying to get the best way of describing
it. Is this like a set of key value pairs where the keys are the textual or visual representation and the values the meaning thereof?
It's more of a conceptual breakdown of some domain of knowledge. So, an ontology for birds would be maybe might be something referring to their ancestry, and so you'd refer to birds that are descended from this kind of birds or birds. So you give this whole ordering of bird organization, or you could have the an ontology for describing characters in fiction. Like any domain of knowledge, you can think of an ontology as it's a set of vocabulary and relationships for describing that domain of knowledge. You need an ontology to do semantic markup because you have to have names. You have to say, like, for example, ontologies are very big in bioinformatics. You want to say, oh, here's a protein. Here's what, you know, an amino acid is. Here's this. And so you'll give all these names for things. But then now you start talking about specific metabolic pathways or a particular organization of tissue types or other things. There's entire ontologies for encoding the relationships between pieces of biological knowledge. And this goes in any domain. And the vision of the semantic web is to have appropriate ontologies to represent these things. Now, I find it really funny people getting into the ontologies because this is an old dream. Artificial intelligence with like expert systems and stuff was founded on trying to do ontology type things.
Aristotle, I think,
that's true. Yeah, it's a very old tradition. But in computer science, this has been around for a while, and if you've ever played with ontologies, I think ontologies, once you have knowledge encoded in an ontology, it's very powerful. You can do lots of automatic manipulation of that information, but getting it into that form is painful. There's a reason why Google does things, for the most part, using keywords. Because there's no inherent structure to them, but they're easy to find. Now, contrast this with something like Wolfram Alpha. You know Wolfram Alpha? Wolfram Alpha? It requires the knowledge that goes into it has to be organized in some way. Has to be encoded into some kind of ontology. And then their engine can go through it and then say, oh, look, I can look up your age because I had some tag saying this is how old you are. As opposed to Google saying, oh, here's an age tag, it's in this document, okay, it's probably your age is some, you know, Abraham Lincoln's age is probably somewhere on the Wikipedia page.
Wikipedia's been doing the little box on the side. It's all semantically marked up. You can do, like, the best Italian tennis player from 1996.
Knowledge representation. But, of course, I hate to see the flame wars that go into deciding what ontology they use for different parts of Wikipedia. Do you notice the recent XKCD?
Yeah.
There's a funny one. It's a funny Wikipedia one about the talk page on the latest Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
That's going to come out next
year. Star Trek issue. Whether or not the uppercase the I.
Anyway, So there is this. The reason why I wanted to make this little side thing is that the semantic part of the original vision of HTML is not dead, but it has gone off in this other thing, and it's this whole other area of web technology which we're really not going to be covering in this class. What has instead taken over is the graphic designers got in on the action, and they said, "Darn it, we want to control exactly how things look on the page." Never mind that someone might actually want to view it at different resolutions and screen sizes and whatever, we're going to specify that the screen has to be at least 600 pixels across. And what if your page is 800 pixels across? Too bad. You're going to have black borders. What if your page is 400 pixels across? Well, you're going to scroll. We now have the technology for doing this wonderful advance in presentation of documents. Visual markup. So visual markup to a first degree is just saying, okay, what font should this text be in? What size should it be in? What color should it be in? But if you start sticking this in the document with the text, you get really annoying documents. And in particular, if you want to have a consistent visual layout for your documents, let's say you're trying to make an entire website consisting of many documents and you want them all to look the same, that's not the way to do it. You don't want to embed it in every page. So HTML was extended with CSS, cascading style sheets.
this is an entire standard for specifying visual presentation of information. Specifying the font, specifying the size, specifying their borders around them. CSS can do all kinds of crazy stuff regarding the layout of elements. Now, you can put CSS in line in HTML documents. You can stick it in there. In general, you don't do that. What you do instead is you create a separate style sheet and you refer to it. So what that means is you create your own visual markup language. You create your own names for properties, mark the properties in your document, and then specify what those properties are in your CSS style sheet. So you want to change how your entire website looks, you don't change the content, you just change the style sheet. And everything changes. So, taking this idea of quote, but this now becomes extensible. You define your own way of doing this. So that's HTML and CSS, but now, so we have a good way of specifying the content of a document, we have a way of specifying how it should look, but now I want to interact with it programmatically. So I want to define event handlers, so I can do that in JavaScript with, you know, by putting these script tags, stick them into the document, now I have code there. In JavaScript I can say I'll register event handlers for this, but how do I interact with this page? You know, this page is this big text document. I mean, you could say, oh, well, it's a big text document. I'm running a program. My program can just output more text and can just read the text and parse it on its own. And you could, in principle, have JavaScript do that, but that would really be annoying, especially since the browser already had to parse the page in order to render it. It had to build its own representation of it. So what the clever folks who built web browsers figured out was when you run JavaScript, when you run code in the browser, it should not access the page directly. It will not modify the text that was downloaded from the web server. Instead, it will manipulate the DOM. Document Object Model. So it means that the browser went through and parsed that page, turned it into a bunch of objects, a bunch of JavaScript objects, organized them together in basically a tree-like structure, and gives you methods for accessing it. So you should go, woohoo, I don't have to parse HTML.
I get to parse the DOM.
Well, you don't parse the DOM, but you have to walk it. You have to access it. And this is where the pain comes. Because HTML was standardized pretty well, but the DOM wasn't. The DOM was not so standardized. And in fact, it got all kinds of messes. We're mostly out of that mess now. Mostly. Because IE6 is mostly dead.
They'll be back.
They'll be back. But even without... IE6 makes it really weird in how you interact with the browser and interact with the DOM because it has its own, you know, things that did not follow the standards that came along later. But there still are various quirks with each particular browser because they're different code bases. Things just are going to be a little different. Programs interpret specs slightly differently. So you want to interact with this. From JavaScript, you have to deal with the differences here. So, if you want to make your life simple, what do?
Use jQuery.
Use jQuery. There are other ways, but...
Or Dojo.
Hmm?
Or Dojo.
Dojo. How popular is Dojo now?
That's what Rails used to use.
jQuery is kind of taking over it.
Yeah.
I'm almost surprised browsers don't start incorporating jQuery natively.
Hey, Mike. But anyway, so there's this. So the DOM is a set of objects, JavaScript objects, and you've seen how mutable, flexible these things are. So there's objects. They have methods associated with them. If you want to find out, and you don't, when you want to query the DOM, you don't just necessarily query one particular element. There's all these things for finding things in the page, for finding things by name, finding things by property. You can, because like let's say you want to turn everything with a certain tag, you know, blue. CSS is defined, you know, maybe, you know, the CSS is one way. Your document has all these tags. JavaScript can now find all these things and change the CSS programmatically. That's what's cool about making an active web page is you have all these technologies for marking up the some data and making it pretty, and then programmatically you can change it as you go. And the DOM is the tool for this, and jQuery is the wrapper around this. So it's just a bunch of JavaScript that you load, and it gives you a completely different, well, not basically, it's very close to the DOM API, but it's all its own API. And it wraps everything that you would normally do through the DOM. And if you do it through jQuery, you can do it the same way on all the browsers. And they deal with compatibility issues.
It's a standard library. Well, it's kind of like a standard library.
Well, so this we get into what... So where this is Node versus... So server-side versus client-side JavaScript. So that's part of why I'm going to this picture. So now we're... So jQuery, this is in the browser. So if you want to use jQuery in your application, what do you do?
You embed it into the HTML files that are...
So what you do is in your HTML file, you add a script tag. And in that script tag, you have a source field. You give it a source, and you tell it to load the source of the jQuery file into the current session. So that code will be loaded in, imported in, and now all of a sudden you have all the jQuery methods. So this is in general how you do things in browser-side JavaScript. I mean, it's just like a requires or other things for Node, but here you just say, this is the URL where this page is. It might be on your server, it might be in some standard place. For something like jQuery, there are standard URLs for grabbing it, which you might want to use, because that way the clients that are accessing your website might not have to load the jQuery library from your server. They might already have a copy lying around, but they won't know whether that copy... The only way to make sure that they have a copy is you have to use it from the same URL they have already gotten it from.
Hosts,
yeah, Google. Yeah, Google hosts it. There are other people who host it. Now, of course, you have to consider that now Google knows whenever your page is getting loaded. But hey, you might be using Google Analytics anyway, so.
Is jQuery a programming language or a library?
It's as close as JavaScript, a client-side JavaScript gets to a library.
So it is JavaScript.
Yes, it is JavaScript. So what it is, it's a bunch of JavaScript that knows about the differences between browsers. It defines a standard API for accessing browser-specific things, primarily the DOM, also for doing things like AJAX and stuff. It understands the browser-specific ways of doing it, and it presents a browser-independent way of doing things. So all the jQuery stuff, so jQuery gives you two things. One is it gives you the jQuery object, which you normally access by dollar sign. But that's the main jQuery namespace. But then this thing will return jQuery objects that you can do stuff with. So this is when you manipulate things in jQuery, you don't manipulate DOM objects. You manipulate jQuery objects. jQuery objects wrap DOM objects. Sometimes that wrapping will be very thin. Sometimes that wrapping will not be. But
The key thing is you don't care. You've got a standard API for doing everything you want to do. So this jQuery, I really think of as a good example of how the flexibility of JavaScript lets you turn an environment that might be really annoying into something that is reasonable. Because it just, you can just use this, it defines the symbol as the function. Now you just access its methods to, you know, to call things, and then it returns, it produces objects. Now, notice you never call new with jQuery. It produces objects, so you could say it's a constructor, but you don't use new. It just, it returns the objects.
You could, but it wouldn't make much point.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I was saying. Most of the time, whenever you could use new, you don't want to use new. it's extra syntactic sugar that doesn't buy you much. But it's used, so you should know it. jQuery's on the client side. This will make your life easier when you're trying to do client-side JavaScript. You don't even have to worry of, I mean, you should learn some about how the DOM works and stuff and the things, but really just learn the jQuery methods. Because they have, most of them have close analogs to the DOM, and they're uniform, and then you're done. And you just have your application load the source code, so, and you're done. Now, we talked about the fact that in JavaScript, you have a global state. On the client side, what's that global state bound to?
The window.
Well, so if you think of it logically, the JavaScript context is the browser window that you're interacting with. That is one context. So the top level object, the global object for JavaScript for a given page, is called window. You don't actually even access it as window, although it always has a property called window that refers back to it. So if you need to do that, but normally you just the global object is your global state is the window. Inside of that, if you want to access things that are shown inside the window, is mostly document, because that's the document in the window. All kind of logical. So where's Node in this? Not in the browser at all. Node is over here.
Well, unless we use Chrome.
It's not Node, but just V8.
Yeah.
V8.
V8, that's not good. Okay. So, jQuery's in the client. That's where you have cascading style sheets. That's where you have HTML. That's the classic home of JavaScript. But what do we want on the server side? What is the job of the server? The server is supposed to take some, you know, so we have some sort of store here. The server is supposed to take information from the store, the requests from the browser, and generate HTML documents with embedded, along with, you know, links to images and cascading style sheets and embedded JavaScript and all this stuff. Now notice, JavaScript is really good at manipulating all the stuff on the client side. Why not use as much of the same technology you can on the server side? Because you're dealing with the same things. You're just producing it for it to be consumed here. That's the idea of Node. That's why we're talking about JavaScript on both sides. It's because saying all this technology was developed for dealing with HTML and CSS through JavaScript. We want to deal with HTML and CSS on the server. Maybe we can use some JavaScript in some way to do that.
But you're not actually, there's no DOM on the server, so.
No, there's not.
The only thing that survived really is the language and the event loop, and that's about it.
The language and the event loop, but also a lot of times, what you're going to be doing is implementing logic to. So where this really pays off is when you start doing asynchronous stuff and wanting to pass state from clients to servers. So
speaking of which, so we're going to be sending data back and forth. So along with this GET request, POST request, we can send a bunch of data with it, and of course we're getting documents back. What sort of data interchange format should we use? So the classic way to do this now is JSON. It used to be people would use XML. So XML looks like HTML. So you can use it, you can parse it and everything. But JSON looks like JavaScript. And it turns out it's easier to parse JavaScript from within JavaScript than to parse XML from within JavaScript. It also has certain properties of getting around certain security restrictions that the browser has, which is good and not good, and we will talk about same origin policy later. But
is an overhead a little thinner here?
For JSON? Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's easier to parse JSON and JavaScript.
But I mean, just in pure.
It's
size.
Also less. It's also smaller.
Yeah. Less
but,
brackets.
That's brackets. I mean, but you got space. I mean, it's not that much. It's cleaner to look at.
It's all gonna be gzipped
anyway. Yeah, so it's all gonna be gzipped, so. But so JSON is gonna go back and forth between these. JSON is JavaScript object notation. You know how we saw that the syntax of JavaScript objects where you have a curly brace and then you have the properties and you have colons and with a semicolon at the end of the close brace? That's all JSON is. JSON is a data exchange format based on JavaScript syntax for specifying objects. So, in other words, you're just passing the textual representation of JavaScript objects back and forth and back and forth. This turns out to be very good for dealing with data on the client side. Well, heck, if that's how you're dealing with data on the client side, why not deal with the data on the same way on the server side? Same language, same semantics. Instead of trying to translate it to Perl, try to translate it to PHP. There are libraries for parsing JSON. I mean, JSON's actually really straightforward to parse, so translating to another language isn't that hard. But that means not only can you have the same data format, you can also have the same logic. And you can even then move logic back and forth. Let's say you write a routine on the server for processing JavaScript or JSON. You realize, wait a second, this will be much better on the client. You don't have to translate the code.
Do you know if databases are something that is supported as this without the way translation?
I think there are JCR. I've heard of such things. MongoDB, I don't know. MongoDB a JSON store, basically?
There's
no,
probably
no,
a bunch of people writing.
It's not specific for JSON.
One of them was
SQL databases. One of those was is a JSON. Yeah. There's nothing particularly magical about JSON syntax. It's actually, but although I have to say it's one of the more readable syntaxes. Huh? What?
YAML is way better.
YAML?
It'll come back.
Okay. So let's talk about Node on the server. If we're going to do Node on the server, we have JavaScript. That's what base node is. It's JavaScript. With a few things for dealing with server type things, like dealing with files and dealing with network sockets and other things. It's got some of the basic infrastructure there. But how do we turn that into something that is easy to program for dealing with this? What we really want is technologies, basically bits of JavaScript that will do parts of this problem here. So what needs to be solved? What do we want to be able to do easily? Well, one thing we want to be able to do is do HTTP easily. Now, there's built in, there's standard just HTTP, but there's more to HTTP than just HTTP. There's also the whole notion of sessions, there's all the browser things of like tab icons and all the kind of semantics you expect of a web browser, like what Apache gives you. How do I get Apache-like semantics when I don't have Apache around?
How am I could code all of it in JavaScript, in Node, and that would be a pain. Better for someone else to have implemented it for me, so I can use it. So, what is that? An idea what that Neo that one of the technologies for that? I mean, there's a couple of them in Node. No, so what we're talking about there is we're talking about Connect. So this is middleware. What this really means is Connect is a framework. Well, Connect is a set of middleware, which means you load this in to Node. This now allows you to load other code in. It's a Connect really is does go by the name Connect because it's for connecting components together. And if you look in the Connect framework, there's all kinds of components that you might want to use to build a web server. So it provides a basic functionality that's kind of some of it's built into Node, and then for other things like cookies, session management, that's all there in Connect. You don't have to figure out like, okay, I can parse my cookies this way. I need to make a cookie parsing thing. I'm gonna encode it here with my session ID. It's got that and a whole bunch of other things built into it. So using Connect, using the components it has now, you have a web server. Yay! But now, what's your web server going to serve? What's going to be the structure of my web application? Connect provides components, but how should I structure that? So the solution we've come up with for as software developers for dealing with issues of structuring code is frameworks. Basically, fill in the blank. Have you covered frameworks in any of the classes?
Just curses?
What?
Curses.
Oh, God. Frameworks is a rather interesting idea for computer science because it's a code reuse idea, but it's kind of it would first seem a dumb way of doing code reuse because it really is fill in the blank. When you use a framework, it gives you lots of blank files. I mean, it says, and so what we're talking about now is Express. Now, Express is built on Connect. Express depends upon it, and much of the so anything that's built for Connect can work with Express. But what the difference is, so Connect is base level code for adding more code to Node in a nice componentized way for doing web server type functionality. Express gives you places to put your code in. It says, you should structure your application like this. You should have it, this part of the functionality should be in this directory. This part of the functionality should be in this directory. Start with this file here. I'll give you a basic application template. So here's some code. Now you have a working application. Hack. Modify it. Stick your code in the appropriate blanks. But I've given you the framework for working on it. So it's kind of like a, if I was going to tell you to write a paper, if I gave you an outline, organize your paper this way. Give me a topic sentence. Then have this, first paragraph describing this, second paragraph describing this, third paragraph describing this. That's all a software framework is. Fill in the blank. Yes?
How does this relate to the Node.js beginner where he walks you through the, I guess he gives you a framework as well where he says,
Right.
This is the router and this.
Yes, exactly.
So Express is basically that.
Essentially.
And what does Connect do?
Connect provides the functionality needed by something like Express. So there's two aspects of reuse. So anything in a framework, you can modify. The framework is a starting point. You don't... It doesn't necessarily give you lots of code. It gives you more structure than code. It gives you a way of organizing your code into pieces and say, if you need this functionality, put it here. If you need this functionality, put it there. So, for example, when you want to have CSS templates, the Express framework has a place to put CSS templates. You're generating templates of HTML. It has a place for doing HTML templates. It has places to put there, and depending on how you want to do it, this is extensible too. It's not a fixed framework. It's an extensible framework. So people have different ways of structuring web applications. Express supports different ways of doing it. But the functionality is not provided by frameworks. Functionality is provided by things like middleware, basically libraries. When we say middleware, what we're really talking about is a way of connecting code together. So on top of Connect is a bunch of modules. You might say, well, why don't I just stick those modules together? Why do I need a software layer for connecting them together? Because you need that for a set of conventions so they know how to talk to each other. It's interconnects. Middleware is about interconnects. It's standardized ways for them to touch each other. So that's why we say, so it's middleware because it's in the middle.
But it basically simplifies, because Node seems very simple to whip up a basic server and get going without any middleware. So
yes.
The middleware is simply
Node by itself can give you a basic web server. But if you want that web server to do more than basic static page service, it's not going to be much fun.
Okay.
You're going to implement everything. I mean, you look at the difference between what a standard web server like Apache provides and what Node provides.
Yeah, it's pretty bare bones.
Node is very bare bones. If you want that more sophisticated thing, you can cook it yourself, or you use someone else's thing. So something like Connect provides you that functionality. But then what? Just having that functionality, how do you structure your web app? That's what a framework gives you, is a nice template. Because no one is good writing from a blank page. Blank pages are a pain. If a framework fits the way you want to think about your application, it makes your life much easier. If the framework does not fit how you want to structure your application, you're going to fight it. So if you find a framework and you have a hard time understanding how it's put together and figuring out the organization of things, like you're like, I want to do this, where would I put it? You don't necessarily have to understand all the magic of how it works together, but if you don't know where to put your code in it and it's not making sense, it's probably not the right framework for you. You don't have to use Express. There are other frameworks out there. Different programmers think of programming in different ways. If you don't like Express, look at the other frameworks. Look at those examples. Maybe they make more sense to you. It's just a matter of preference. So, Express gives you... So these give you together... this gives you the functionality for a web server. This gives you a template for filling in the parts of a web server that you might want to modify, extend... But what about this HTML and CSS stuff? Are you going to hand code and do everything with manipulating the HTML and CSS pages you want to generate for your web browsers? You could. Perfectly possible. Perfectly reasonable. Except that it's a pain. So why not make your life simpler? So... Associated with Connect and Express are another two pieces of technology of Node.
Oh, you said hire someone.
Hire someone, yeah. But that's in effect what you're doing. That's the nice thing about using these things. So here we're talking about... So I just want to make sure I don't get these mixed up. So.
Oh, God. I'm going to make sure I don't. Okay. Yes. Okay, good. That's a template enter. Okay.
To create a web page.
What you're in general doing is you have some boilerplate of how the page is always going to look. Some parts of the page will be the same always. Other parts of the page will change. There's a couple of strategies for how to do this. There's the PHP way, which Rails also kind of does this too, or there's which is to say,
so Jade, an alternative for this is embedded JavaScript.
So one way to do this is you have an actual HTML page. You have it set up exactly as you want it, and then in certain spaces you say, here's some JavaScript code to do what it's supposed to do, you know, to fill this in. This was the original idea behind PHP, is that most of your document would look like an HTML document, and you'd stick code in the right places. And that code would then run to mutate that part.
On the server?
On the server. This is all, how do you generate valid HTML documents to send to the client? Some of that will be boilerplate. Some of that you'll code by hand. You'll just say, this is what it's going to look like. It's going to have this doc type. It's going to have this here. You just structure it. Banner of your page or logo, whatever, that'll always be the same. But then the content of your page will change. And that, so then you say, in this part, fill it in with the customer information. So you put a little bit of code right there. That's the embedded JavaScript way of doing it, is you stick a little JavaScript into this basic HTML page and you get it. Still deal with HTML though. Kind of ugly. Pain to read. So instead, Jade gives you a nice clean way of representing HTML. Basically, HTML without angle brackets. No, you don't have to specify the tags. Instead, you say, okay, I want a header here, I want, you know, this boldface, here's I want a div here. You just do it by indenting and things, and it all looks very clean. I have to say I like that syntax a lot better. This is something that Express gives you. You don't have to use it. But by default, I think Express automatically includes it, or it's very easy to include Jade. This is in the example I gave you, they use these things. They use Express and Stylus. But again, there's alternatives for each of these pieces. I'm not saying you have to use these, but these seem relatively easy to get started with. You specify your HTML page using a nice HTML-like syntax, but it's much simpler. You put in what you want, where you want code, you say, here it is, and then it will generate full HTML pages for you on the fly.
I'm guessing all
these stuff is in source. Yeah. Stylus says, I want to do the same thing for CSS, but CSS is not normally that dynamic. So instead, you specify the simplified syntax, and then it compiles it down to real CSS and sticks it in the right directory. And when you change the source files, it will automatically compile it down, but it won't be doing it on every page load. So this is something that would be running for every page that's grabbed. This is something that would just whenever you change the styling of your site. So notice that there's all these technologies that the web browsers implement, and you have to support them on the server in some way. But other programmers have dealt with the pain already. And so you don't have to deal with all those technologies in their raw form. And in this day and age, I mean, if you really are
as you become an experienced developer, if you're going to continue working in the space, you'll have to master more and more of the underlying technologies, if anything, just to debug them. So you can have control of it and say, this is what it is. But if you're just trying to build a basic application, you don't have to worry about that stuff. Use this stuff. Use these higher level abstractions. Let someone else have dealt with the pain. And that's bizarre.
Oh, wow. And we are out of time. So, questions. Let me just go through the questions here. If you haven't done the... So again, client-side JavaScript for abstracting browser-specific behavior when accessing DOM elements That's repetitive there. jQuery. Standard for encoding data, particularly for transport using JavaScript-like syntax. JSON. Node.js framework for creating web applications.
Express.
Node.js extensible HP server middleware. Connect. HTML template engine for Node.
Jade.
Yeah. Cleaner CSS syntax.
Stylus.
Sessions impose a strict ordering on HTTP requests and web applications. True or false?
False.
False.
Wait.
What?
Start again.
Just what's Node? JSON? Yeah. What is it? You know. Yeah. jQuery. Node. Yeah. Let's try not Node. jQuery. JSON. Express. Connect. Jade and stylus. Okay. I got through my questions. Woohoo! You must be a bit bored.
I don't know. Yeah, it's